Cardi on the track.
Hey there, and welcome to Backjack, the Samurai Jack Rewatch Podcast. And this one is entitled Jack and the Woolies and the How do you say that? Crichtolites?
The Crichtolites.
They're kind of critchy, I guess. They certainly critch at each other a lot.
I don't know. It almost looks like how Michael Crichton spelled his name.
But the CH was silent because he was all fancy with it and shit. So anyway, we have an episode, a brief episode synopsis, as we do at the top of the show, to be done by my good and dear friend, Matt Collins. Render us your poetry, sir.
Samurai Jack meets a recently established colonial culture and their beasts of burden. But not all is as it seems. Will Jack succeed in establishing a post-colonial republic of revolutionaries? Or will the settler aliens and their obnoxious voices rule unopposed?
You really think they're gonna rule unopposed?
That sounds ridiculous.
I don't even know what we're talking about here.
No, but really, their voices were quite obnoxious.
Terribly obnoxious. Horribly obnoxious. On purpose. Like, they tried, they must have told whoever the voice actor was that did literally every single alien voice exactly how to make the most annoying. It was like a cross between Mandark and Jack Nicholson.
Yeah. Have you ever been in a hobby store before? I'm going to need you to make that voice.
And not a single one of them said, well, actually. I was waiting for the whole time for them to start, like, alien-splaining to Jack what was going on. But it seems to me as if... Well, actually... So, the episode opens in a beautiful, lush, gorgeous, sort of deciduous jungle. And Jack is obviously very hungry. So he's setting a snare, which I think was pretty cool. He was not actually trying to hunt with the sword. Like, he was trying to set a trap.
Slightly irritating. I guess if anybody could pull it off, he could. Well, but
he can throw the sword. I mean, like,
yeah, he's established that.
unerringly so. Like, it's not possible. Like we said, don't ever throw your sword. But in Jack's case, he can. And he seems to be able to hit really hard with some degree of accuracy. I guess he would be scared of, like, scaring off the game if he did that because he's got to haul back to do it. But yeah, he sets a snare, which he probably learned from, like, Robin Hood or maybe Mufasa out in the desert. And a wild boar comes up to sniff at it when all of a sudden...
A giant, well, let's call it woolly.
Not a mammoth. It's got sort of a human face. It's just a woolly.
Stampedes through. And he's caught on a rope hanging off of it where we see a familiar sight. As Andy noted.
Yeah, this is like a cowboy trope. And this was actually a punishment that they used to do in a lot of places, which is literally drag you behind a horse. Like, it's the simplest possible way to do damage to someone without actually, like, beating them. You just tie a rope around their ankles and drag them. Like, they do this in old cowboy movies, and Indiana Jones paid homage to it.
And Red Dead Redemption.
Really? That was in Red Dead Redemption?
Oh, yeah. You could take out your lasso and just...
Lasso the bad guys and
drag
pull behind
people
the horse.
Through fields of cacti.
Yeah,
I mean, it's already bad enough, but
totally
you also took them straight through the cacti too. Like, I know this was already painful, but
this is a final fuck you. The cactus. How do you like that shit? So, Jack is being pulled along by the rope, which is somehow tangled around his ankle, as the woolly is just going crazy, running through the forest, very scared look on his face. And Jack is attempting to kind of try to get control of it. But unfortunately, it's being pursued by three strange little creatures with weird square jaws that are riding on other woolies and attempting to chase that one down. And Jack makes probably the right decision here, which is this thing is going to hurt somebody. So I just need to stop it. So he, using his horsemanship training, is able to throw the lasso thing around its front legs and make it do literally a face plant, slides along the ground just before it reaches the end of a cliff, meaning it has nowhere else to run off to, which is useful for the next scene where the little white guys catch up. So these three guys approach Jack, who has brought the woolly to heel, and it is now just sitting there. And they all talk in this very weird, annoying voice.
And that voice isn't weird. You haven't even heard my weirdest voice.
And they come up to him and say,
not a bad job with the beast, I guess. We would have caught him anyway with our modified tridental incapacitators. Whatever. Secure the beast! This beast is always trying to escape. Your days are numbered, Wild One. Thanks to this brave warrior, you'll never escape again. We must celebrate its capture. Come back to our village with us.
Well, I don't know if I...
You should. There'll be a feast with rare delectables.
Well, I have not eaten in days. I suppose no harm could come of it.
And he's really hungry, and he's like, okay, morally this doesn't quite feel right, but I am hungry. So he joins them for the ride back. We're riding through this beautiful junglescape, and we're starting to see a little bit more about who these guys are. And it comes out that they're, like, terribly colonial. Like, everything about the way they're approaching it. Like, every single phrase out of these little motherfuckers' mouths is something that has been parroted by colonial forces in the world somewhere.
Yeah.
Again, Samurai Jack doesn't really couch its metaphors very carefully.
Yeah.
They just splat them right on the screen, like thrown red paint on a person wearing a fur in the 80s.
No, yeah, we could see very clearly and quickly. The show establishes that the aliens are sort of an analogy to settlers in the New World. And the Woolies are some kind of exploited slave laborers. It's repeated with excruciating emphasis, and we're sort of given the impression that's what we're supposed to be drawing from it.
Our people have dwelled in this land for many decades. Much of it was barren wasteland when the first settlers arrived. Our ancestors worked long and hard for many seasons to cultivate it into the beautiful place it is now. These Woolies, as we call them, once roamed the land, wild. These bloodthirsty creatures threatened the survival of our early settlers, nearly driving us to extinction. Anyway, with our great courage and determination, we managed to tame these savage beasts.
The evil capitalist space nerds. Like, yeah. Literally, like, they were drawn and voiced like evil capitalist space nerds. They're literally white.
Yeah.
With blue skin, like blue blood. Like, they're literally the oppressors.
And we see them, like, you know, coveting each other's rare items, and it's
a little bit later. Yeah, we'll get there. But they say things like, it was hard work to tame this savage land, and, you know, oh, we tamed these bloodthirsty savages. And and it cuts to a shot of the Woolly, and the Woolly has a very sad face, and it's got blocky square teeth. And you're like, bloodthirsty savage?
Yeah.
It's got blocky square teeth. That's not the teeth of a predator. Like, sorry. That's not right.
It's really a give and take. You know?
They take everything. Yeah, the slave give everything. That's how it works.
We use the land, and in return, we allow them to live in our shelters. And
yeah, they arrive back at what should be like their super little guy alien city, where Jack should be the giant. And instead, it's all this overgrown ruin. And this is the first ruin Jack has really seen in this world. Like, when he's seen other stuff, you know, he's seen the city ruins, but those belong to the dogs. Those were very obviously destroyed ruins, not neglected ruins. Like, somebody attacked that city and destroyed those buildings. It's like they look shattered and broken with holes in them. These just look like they've been degraded, like pieces have fallen out of the ceiling. And he kind of looks around and he's like,
these buildings seem quite old.
Thank you.
Yeah. He doesn't...
Thanks him for it? What? Yeah. Well, it's the whole thing. They're like taking credit. Everything that was built up around here.
Yeah.
And all of the resources they claim to be using, they're just like, oh, it's ours. We took it. We worked so hard to make all of this.
It took us a long time to make this place as beautiful as it is, you know?
Yeah.
You know, we see them introduce Samurai Jack to their way of life, which essentially is demonstrated as we see a sort of a panning shot of everyone going about their daily business. So the various Critchelites are all bartering and trading. They're all arguing about who's nerdy goods are more valuable than the others and who got the better deal and
wait, what are you doing? You can't get this one anymore. It's the Junga Import Edition. Theirs is better, I guess. But I got the exact one in Sarsifis for only 10 pieces, still wrapped.
Oh, yeah, one of them had, like, a little action figure. It's like, well, I have the other one, and it's still in the plastic.
Yeah.
There's guys over there playing, like, some kind of little game, and there was, I think I saw Magic the Gathering cards being traded at one point.
Yeah, something along those lines.
And
then it cuts to Samurai Jack being handed a couple of fruits and some kind of drink that he chokes down. And while he starts to, you know, enjoy the goods he's been given after being hungry for so long, we see that they bring in some entertainment. And
just like this little cockfighting ring, honestly.
It's a circus, really.
Yeah, it's like a circus thing. At first you thought, oh, they're going to make him fight, or they're going to, like, do lances on Willyback or something. But no, they just, like, act like an evil carnival master. That they didn't have a top hat.
Yes.
Evil nerds.
But every time he swung his shock prod, it made a whip sound, which I found interesting. It's almost as if,
space magic, Matt. It's just, actually, it's technological. We know for a fact they say it's technological. They say when we got here, we used our technology to, you know, help do this. And it should also be noted that as a circus trope, what they were kind of trying to call into the show here, it was often noted in the 1800s that circus animals were horribly treated. They were just literally used to the point of, and then basically killed and fed to some of the other animals. They would just constantly be importing new
animals. Yeah, use them until they're utterly exhausted. And then when they seem to be not producing, you just kill them and turn them to kibble.
Well, there's Africa's a big continent, and you can always pay a safari guy a couple $100 to go out in the African bush and bring you back a zebra or...
Yeah, it's worth noting that...
Another elephant or a lion.
That they literally used elephant sound effects for these guys a lot of times, so...
They were trying to evoke that sort of... They're half woolly mammoth, half yak, half... half uplifted sentient being, like... All those halves overlapped.
Yeah. They have a baboon nose, but they've got, like... They've got a woolly mammoth's body. It was weird. But, you know, you get the feeling that this is some sort of magical beast. Speaking in D&D terms, if I was to give it a subtype, it would be magical beast.
Mm-hmm. There's a line from the movie Blazing Saddles, which occurred to me as I was watching this, because the woolies were so reluctant to get in there and do anything. And near the beginning of Blazing Saddles, where... they're facing the evil, horribly racist, railroad foreman. Who's like, why aren't you singing? When you were slaves, you sang all the time. And I'm just thinking about this, like, well, the Woolies aren't going to sing because they have this electric shock collar around their necks.
Yep. Which,
you know, slavers in the past could have only dreamed of.
Yeah, that would have been bad.
Just horrible, horrible shit. And even Jack says something about,
I notice your treatment of the Woolies is somewhat harsh.
Really horrible, terrible lie, which is...
Not really. It's no different than the way you humans treat, what do you call them? Horses?
And that's not exactly true, because in almost every culture in human history, beasts of burden were revered. You took care of them. They were almost a part of your family. You know, you brushed them down, you gave them good food, you made sure that the saddles were comfortable, that, you know, the horse collar was an immensely popular and revolutionary invention, because you didn't have to, like, put leather straps around the horse. You know, it was actually a padded ring around their neck and chest, which meant the horse could go a lot longer without getting chafed. You know, well, what did they care if a horse got chafed? Well, they did, actually. Men would talk about horses the way that guys used to talk about cars, or you and I talk about computer games. Pretty obsessive for them. They loved their horses. In this case, they were treating them like circus animals, which is basically slaves. I mean, that right there should have twigged Jack off that, wait a minute, I know how horses are treated. Okay, I spent my early childhood treating horses, and we never treated horses like this.
Well, you actually see him, like, you know, he puts his thumb and forefinger on his chin after that guy says that, like,
things are not what they seem.
Yeah.
I should investigate this a little further.
And then we see a scene where this really brought up something interesting to mind for me. We see a scene where after the feast and the partying, everyone goes to sleep. And the Kryptolites are everywhere. They're just lying about in all these different buildings, yeah, inside these weird pits. Wherever they just end up is where they sleep. And it really made me start to think, what are these buildings? These buildings don't appear to actually have a purpose, even when they were in control of the Woolies.
Mm-hmm.
There is no purpose to the way these buildings were made. And
they didn't serve a societal purpose the way we would understand as humans. They were not marketplaces. They were not temples. They were not emergency services. They were not government structures. They were not anything. They were not built for any reason that humans would build a structure. And that's another cool undertone to the Woolies and another cool clue about who they really are, I think. I'm sorry, I interrupted you. No, go on.
That's exactly right. We later get a better idea of why these buildings even exist, but I just thought it was interesting as I watched it, just sort of realizing, like, the Kryptolites don't know what these buildings are for either.
They don't care. I have a theory. Right. It's pretty clear. I mean, you get this towards the end if you're paying attention to the Kryptolites, but it's obvious, you know, when we're reviewing it here, that I think those suits take care of just about everything for them. Like, everything.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, it takes care of elimination. It takes care of hot and cold. And it takes care of any bodily function. Suit. Yeah, it's almost a space suit that they're wearing.
Yeah, like, it's so comfortable and nice in there. Maybe that you could just lay pads. Down yeah. wherever you want and snore in that obnoxious way they snore.
In that case, the Kryptolites didn't need buildings either. They weren't living in their spaceships. They fell asleep wherever the hell they wanted to fall asleep.
Yes.
I mean, that's what you would do if you were in a spacesuit. It's kind of in The Martian a little bit in the movie, where it's like it just showed him laying down and taking a break wherever. He didn't actually stay inside the little mobile Mars unit, the little Martian minivan. You know, he got out and walked around and stuff, but he's wearing a spacesuit. It's its own portable environment. It's as comfortable as it needs to be on the inside. And you get the impression that these things are capable of spaceflight. They're not from Earth.
Right.
And
yeah.
Who knows how many other places that they go and visit and exploit or just use. I kind of wanted to point out too, their evil parallels Aku's evil. And you can kind of see where, like, they're not terribly proactive. Once a thing is there, it's just there. And they don't have any ambition beyond that. You know, they weren't building a mighty empire with the Woolies. They weren't putting them into forced breeding programs. You know, they weren't doing medical experiments. They weren't doing all the crap that a human empire might do to exploit a much larger slave race, at least in the past. So they basically are self-contained units, but they're all the same. You got to wonder, maybe they're clones.
Uh-huh.
Maybe all of them are clones. Maybe they don't really care. They all talk the same. They all think the same. They all speak with the same voice. This group of tiny nattering nabobs that just do whatever they want.
Well, you know,
mean-spirited nattering nabobs.
It could be the case. I mean, look how many there are. You know, how do you get a really numerous spacefaring race? You know what? Cloning is probably a big part of that. Just colonizing a planet with a large number of people could be a good idea, especially if you don't need them to breed. You know?
Yeah, we didn't see any women Kryptolites. We didn't see any children Kryptolites. They didn't build buildings. The only things that they were really concerned about were selfish fanboy concerns.
Well, you know, first wave you send into any new place when you're colonizing doesn't include women and children. It doesn't even include farm animals. That's it includes true. The people you would send to conquer a location. And
so set up a fort.
Maybe
secure
this,
the common defense.
Maybe this culture clones those people that it's going to use.
That would be – no, that's a funny headcanon right there. That maybe all Kryptolites aren't like this. Maybe just this batch of clones is like this on purpose. We're going to send in the least motivated, most mean-spirited member of our race because those are the two traits that will absolutely cow a population. Mean-spirited and unambitious. We're just going to put them there, tell them what to do and set things up, keep the population in line. They won't rebel against the right. main race of people.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have anything in mind other than action figures and who has what over whom. They're petty.
Yep.
You know, and they're self-enclosed in their own suits. So there's no females there. Like they weren't interested in any normal biological concern as we see it. They don't care. They literally are little robots that came in and took over.
Yeah.
No personality at all. Well, maybe a bad one.
They have personality. It's, in fact, they're overflowing with personality.
Personality.
Like, what was that?
Oh, nothing. Anyways.
Like, what the heck? Like,
it's almost like they told the voice actor to just be like the most annoying college roommate you ever had. Just act like him. But yeah, Jack sneaks out in the night after all of the Critcholites have literally simply fallen over to go to sleep. Yeah, the suits must take care of something. We don't see any latrines. We don't see any buildings that they built. Nothing. They don't even go back to their ships. Their ships are all overgrown at the end. So they certainly eat and they certainly drink. Where is it going? We don't ever see that. So Jack sneaks away while they all sleep all at the same time because they're all in the same sleep schedule without night guards to protect them against anything else.
Yep.
That also plays in a little bit later when Jack talks to the Mega Wooly, where they say we had a peaceful society. Like, there were no external threats.
Right.
It allowed them to hit the very tippy top of that Maslow's pyramid where they're enlightened. They're worried about their emotional state and their joy and their art and stuff. So he finds the Wooly locked up in one of the few places with a door. Maybe even that was one of the few things that the Critcholites actually constructed or refabricated from local materials.
Yeah, it looked like that part was wood and just sort of cobbled onto the already extant building.
Unambitious. Whatever works. Just enough to keep this animal caged up so we can sleep.
We've spent enough time here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, Jack has a moment with the Wooly. You know, he brings him an apple, puts it through the cage bars and tries to be kind to it the way that he's learned to be kind to horses and other beasts.
Exactly, including wiping the slobber off right back off, on the animal.
You're a good boy, aren't you? Wipe, wipe, wipe. Yeah. Just wipes the slobber. And this is a really neat little scene because the thing starts to look a little less sad. Like, oh, an apple, a treat. Who is this guy? Jack's like, well, I guess it must be pretty hard for you here. And he turns away to leave. And before he can get too far, the Wooly starts to speak to him and says,
help me.
What?
Hey, you, get away from there.
Very simple, very plaintive. Help me. And that stops Jack short. As soon as that happens, like 5 or 6 of the little fuckers show up.
Yeah.
Get away.
Zap, 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 zap.
You should be careful. The beasts are tricky. Their mind control will fry your brain. Come, dessert is served.
Their mind control will melt your brain.
Again, but this is the third interaction where he's questioned their motives and has been gaslighted.
Oh, yeah.
Third time these little goddamn blue guys have gaslighted our hero, who's still only 25, 26, but I think he knows truth when he sees it.
Yeah.
He's trying to make sure that the truth that he's observing is the truth that he feels is true. So he went to see for himself. He went to talk to the Wooly himself. He, you know, risked a little bit to try to get the answer. You know, he'd already had his food. Again, Jack could have just walked away.
Yep.
Once he had eaten, all he had to do was thank you, but I must get moving. All right. Well, thanks for stopping by. Anytime. And they wouldn't have cared. The Critcholites are self-centered little bastards. They wouldn't have talked him out of it.
Yep.
Jack could have just kept walking. You know, you captured one of our escaping beasts. We gave you a meal, even trade. They would have had no problem with that.
Yeah, they almost seem prone to distraction, honestly. I mean, just look at all the times you see them. They should have noticed him sneaking around. And characters actually hear him. They go, what was that? And the other guy's like, what was what? Yeah. Oh, nothing. Yeah. Anyways.
Yeah, exactly. They're not motivated. There's nothing in their tiny heads inside of the white helmets and their big lantern jaws. There's nothing in there that indicates that they have any ambition or culture whatsoever outside of whatever their own little personal needs are. So even the concept of guarding something, you have to other something. You have to think outside of yourself. You have to think in terms of, okay, I'm guarding it. What am I looking out for? Who's possibly, why were there even guards walking around? Who were they expecting to attack? Like, nobody, really. Like, that place was peaceful for a long time.
Yeah, and you can see they were clearly distracted. They were talking about, once again, someone else having, they coveted something from someone else. Like, it seems like that's what they spend most of their time thinking about is who's getting one up on the other. Actually, it's an interesting point. The couple of times we hear the Woolies speak in here, you know, because he's sneaking in, he rescues the one Wooly from his cage.
and they go to try and meet up with the other Woolies. And what we discover in his interactions with this Woolie is the Woolies seem to always speak in a very humble, respectful voice. And true, the Critcholites are constantly sarcastic and snarky. Like,
can't get enough of that. This is too hilarious. They always talk, no matter what they're saying, they sound that way.
Yeah.
They probably don't sound that way to each other because they're all clones.
Right.
I mean, headcanon accepted on this one, guys. They're clones. They're fucking clones. And when they're talking to each other, it's like they're talking to themselves, which is fine for such self-satisfied, unambitious,
narcissistic yeah.
people. They found the most narcissistic clone so that he would be happy talking to himself as clones. And also, like narcissists and sociopaths, they gaslight. They lie about stuff. I mean, like, they fit the profile pretty close for how they're dealing with both the Woolies and with Jack. And at this point, you know, we go to commercial break after they zap the Woolie. And we wake up from the commercial break in this beautiful, oh, God, just, like, awesome storyboard, guys, with this purple night in the background and this gorgeous black shadows of curlicues and leaves and impression. And Jack standing there as a black outline with two white eyes.
The like, omen.
It's just so cool. And at first, you're not sure what's happening here until, like, a couple of cuts later, and you're like, oh, okay, this is probably a dream. And he's being basically called. He is being contacted in his dream.
By a Woolie with glowing eyes. That's what was in the dream, was a Woolie with glowing eyes.
And when he sees this thing, it looks monstrous. It stands up like 25, 30 feet tall, looking down with an angry gaze. Now, the thing is, the angry gaze was not directed at Jack. The angry gaze was righteously pissed for being
It's the trapped. Tormented spirit of the Woolies, yes.
And they were looking for justice, not vengeance. Like, that scowl was a scowl of justice, you know, Batman style. It wasn't a scowl of, and we will pound them into blue paste. You know, it was, we mentioned this in one of our other podcasts, which is something that gets lost even in modern now in 2017, which is just because I'm nice doesn't mean I'm weak. Just because I'm enlightened doesn't mean I won't fight. Just because I speak of peace and art and love doesn't mean you can't get me angry to the point where I'm going to defend myself.
Right.
Like, there seems to be this notion that if you're peaceful, somehow you're not strong. And the Woolies prove that completely wrong in everything that they do. So Jack wakes up from this very disturbing dream of an enormous Woolie with glowing eyes and decides he's going to head back and free
that one. Yeah.
Because this is not, he's compelled to do so. Like, again, he doesn't walk away. Any other sane person would have had a nightmare like that and gone, the Woolies do have mind powers, just like the little bastards told me. I should get out of here before they control the rest of my dreams. Like, any sane person would have gone,
right, like, I have a very important mission.
I can't stick around here and get nightmares because
I wouldn't want the council to be kept waiting.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to keep the council waiting. Yeah. Call back to our Mass Effect digression we did on. Anyway, so when he finally gets there and we see the Woolie again, I noticed something as we were watching the episode again. When we see the Woolie and cut to him again, the window is opened and there's a shaft of light that comes in.
Yep.
For the third time in the episode, when it cuts to the face of the Woolie is boxed in. The first time we see him, it's the outline of the actual frame of the show. The next time is when we see his face in between the bars, inset in the bars with all the wood around him.
Help me.
Yeah. And the third time is when Jack sneaks up to the window and the moonlight's coming through and it's laying on the floor and the shaft of moonlight coming through the window frames his face. And every time we've seen this Woolie's face, they're driving the point home. He's boxed in. They're slaves. They can't move. And he's in a cell also. So that's kind of a hint.
Yep.
But all of these things that they're telling us with the visual storytelling style that Jack is so wonderful for is telling us these things are enslaved. No, you're right to be here. That wasn't a scary dream. That was a dream to compel you to help.
Right.
At this point, he's able to get the door open, get the Woolie out. This time, they're all really sleeping. But they have to be remarkably stealthy to get past all of the carpet of sleeping space nerds. And they do. Which is kind of impressive that something that large and woolly can move that quietly. But
and can we just take a moment to appreciate the sound they make when they sleep in this giant pile? the, like, sound that Gendy must have come up with here for this pile of sleeping assholes is perfect. They're still irritating even when they're snoring.
In sleep.
Like, you, even the stance they sleep in is irritating. Did you notice that? Like, the way he has them sleeping.
Their arms are kind of out to one side. Like, they're taking
up as much room as they can.
They're
man-spreading. They're so irritating. Every aspect he could make irritating about them, he absolutely did.
Which must have been really fun in the writer's room. Like, okay, you guys, what are the most annoying fucking traits you can think of? Yeah. Like, we want to make these aliens not evil, just really annoying.
Yeah, like, they don't even sleep on couches or beds. They're just fucking lying around on the stairs.
And you can't even withhold stuff to them to make them go because that suit takes care of everything. And they're all fucking clones.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, let's get to work on this. And half the storyboard wall is covered with annoying traits.
Yeah, people exactly. That they know.
But, like, I mean, when they're doing this, maybe that's why they don't have bunks or anything. They're too narcissistic to want to organize to sleep together.
Yeah.
Like, they just sleep wherever because literally all the rest of them annoy all the rest of them.
Yeah, so like, you can see they're just, like, spreading out as much as they can.
But this leads, you know, they have to sneak through these pillars, and that's where your little quote comes from. And they make it past them, not really all that hard, except for the aforementioned, how does something that large move that silently? I guess there's a lot of wool to take up sound. And they reach this bigger than normal dome tower. And at the top of it, there seems to be something awaiting Jack. And the Woolly says, yeah, go.
Up,
go. And when Jack is doing, like, okay, well, first of all, the Woolies had stairs. And that really seems to indicate, you know, four-legged things don't like stairs much. Like, if the world was designed by four-legged things, they would use ramps. They wouldn't use stairs to get somewhere high.
Right.
That's a human thing. People with two legs do that. So Jack climbs up these stairs, which are, like, waist high, and gets to the top. And at the top is Jerry Garcia. No. I mean... At the top is a giant, enlightened mega woolly who has been apparently there for a very long time. He's got beautiful rushing locks off the top of his enormous head. I guess woolies don't have to use product. And he's basically stuck. Like, this enlightened woolly can't do anything. He can't leave. He won't leave. He's not going to leave his people.
Well, they had them all fenced in, too, if you noticed. Cause when they first entered the area where this dome was, Jack unlocks it, with the hairpin.
Oh, right. I missed that part. Right. We can add lockpicking to the skill set that Jack has. Where would he have learned lockpicking? Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Robin Hood and his merry band of thieves would have included at least one person that knew how to pick a medieval lock, which that's all that was. It's a simple rolling tumbler thing to keep it closed. And. You know, we have this wonderful thing where he goes up to it fearful. But again, Jack isn't scared of anything. He has a bit of concern.
He's been put through a lot already.
He has indeed. And this is scary, but also something from his dream. And he might be feeling apprehensive, but he's not scared. So he walks right up to Jerry Garcia, and Jerry Garcia wakes up and shoots him with amazing eye lasers.
Yeah, sure enough, by the way, this woolly has glowing eyes.
The woolies are, at this point, confirmed they're supernatural.
Or at least this one. This one's gained some kind of enlightenment.
And the enlightenment, as it takes place for woolies, is beneficial. Like, it's all about mindset. It's all about, I mean, he is obviously existing there and hasn't gone mad from just sitting there the whole time.
Yeah.
He's sort of Yoda-like. Like,
it reminds me of the monks on the mountain that his father got the sword from.
Yeah, actually, that's a nice callback. I like that because they spent their whole lives up there or whatever and learning how to commune with the gods, learning how to look out at the universe, which again, they just, in that episode, The Birth of Evil, part two, when we see him get the sword and talk through the monks, the universe is in their eyes. The humans are grokking the universe, man, and it's halfway hallucinogenic and halfway transcendental.
Yeah, and you see, what the Woolies have experienced has nothing to do with celestial space.
True.
So what does the Woolie transfer to Jack through his weird enlightenment eyes? he transfers the history of his people. And what we get is an interesting revelation.
Well, he says his name is Lazor, I believe. The eldest of the Woolies.
Yep. He suggests that his society existed before the darkness fell. And they show a lunar eclipse, a full lunar eclipse, which we haven't seen since the birth of evil.
Since when Aku came out the right. second time. And,
so,
and the part of that, they're not really clear on it about, do they mean before the Critcholites came or do they mean before Aku came to power? Because if that's
did
true,
the Critcholites appear during another eclipse? Does Aku get strong on every eclipse? Does, you know, oh, what's shit. Going on, you know?
That would make sense. Like if there was enough power, if he had accrued enough misery and hate and ruin just being stuck underground for 20 years or 5 years, 8 years, however long between the birth of evil and this episode, we see, okay, well, Aku, if he's blocked, if the sun is blocked, Ra's power isn't getting here, Aku can get stronger. Maybe it was that the first whole swath of his initial expansion was just waiting for the next eclipse,
right,
which,
yeah.
you know, partial eclipses happen all the time. Full eclipses happen every 8 or 10 years. When that happens, during the time period for those few hours, Aku is just uber powerful and can just lay waste to things. It would almost seem to be that he would be looking forward to those and saying, okay, this is the place I'm going to take next. So slowly over the course of the first 1,000 years, he's just taking over more and more area. Every time there's an eclipse, he can move to the next civilization and plunder them.
So what we see is potentially they existed before the first, like, bad eclipse that is signaled the end of the world.
And we said that back in that episode. It's implied with that green poison that there is indeed supernatural stuff in this world.
Yeah.
They had enough alchemy to say this poison should kill whatever the hell this dragon or giant goat or whatever attacks
shifting monster.
Yeah, this should kill it. You know, this is a magical poison for the magical things that attack us. So it was known that there were magical things in the world, but
right.
they weren't real active in hunting them down except when they had to. So in this case, that would seem to give that theory some weight.
Yeah. And so, you know, the more we see of this vision of his people's history, we see that for one, we see what those buildings were for. The buildings were just, they were displays for the murals being painted on the roofs.
Mm-hmm.
So these interesting columned buildings that don't have walls, they just have these columns. And the roof above is the actual center of the building, the purpose of the building, because it's been painted with all these images of the Woolies doing things or something in history.
Well,
you know,
get the impression the Woolies, much like the Critcholites, don't need much. They are so internally powerful. Extremes of heat and temperature don't hurt them. They're in a jungle. Food is plentiful for such a small population.
Right.
There's plenty of water around.
Although we still see them farming.
Mm-hmm. A little bit.
In the flashback, he says, you know,
I am Lazor, the eldest of Woolies. Countless seasons ago, before the darkness fell, we were a happy people. We had discovered a way of life that most creatures only dream about. Paradise. Ours was not a culture based on technology. Our village was prosperous. But then they came. The pestilence that rained out of the sky. The Critcholites were upon us. At first, we tried to defend ourselves, but we were no match for their technology. Using the power of the orb, the Critcholites have enslaved us to their service. For decades, they have abused our land. And if they are not stopped, I fear my people will soon fade from history. Will you help us?
I will.
Oh, they're picking fruit and throwing
that
it in the back.
They've got
back
baskets and yeah. baskets of fruit. Like, they would have been set pretty much permanently if not for the settlers, the Critchellites.
I think also they were able to farm enough to keep that population going, and it was good food. They didn't have to do a lot of farming.
Yep.
Like, when you're just feeding yourself and you're not trying to feed an army, literally, for your government to go conquer other peoples, you can get by on truck farms mostly. You need a couple of fields, but I mean, even the settlers in America, when they came here, they used to have a concept called the commons. So whenever you hear about,
the tragedy of the commons,
and the commons, the tragedy of the commons being if everyone does it, if one person doesn't, why doesn't everybody get away with doing it? But the idea is the commons are the fields around the village that you can choose to farm. It's just there. They at least had that connection with the land in common with some of the natives that I need this many square acres to grow this much barley or this much wheat, and I'm going to have this much to trade. I have this much time to work it. I have one oxen and not two, so that's going to slow me down. I've got one smaller barn, and the market is that way, and I shouldn't grow more than that because it'll just rot before I can sell it. So you know what would just mark off the commons and say, this is what I'm going to farm.
You know, it would be a lot easier if we had some woolies.
It would be if the woolies were willing to be paid well to harvest the ground fruit things that they had.
Oh, they'll be paid all right, Zot.
Yeah.
In pain.
I can imagine that, like, Aku saw these little squirrely guys when he talks about when they come, that they just shoot out of the sky like giant phallic bits of Aku raining down. Those are clearly Aku-designed spaceships.
Yeah.
Like, they
the ships
them
they appear on, they almost look like syringes with Aku's horns on the side. And they appear to be injecting the settlers into the natural surroundings of this land. Like, it's, you know, there's this visual metaphor being made that they're being injected into this world, you
black
know?
Needles in their disease. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't fit. You notice that too? That fits that theme. They have white suits and blue faces. Nothing else in the Woolies world is white and blue. Everything else is natural colors. These are two very unnatural colors on these little bastard clone things. And they're striking in every way. And in every way, they're different from the Woolies. They're angular where the Woolies are round. They're annoying where the Woolies are peaceful.
And they respectful.
And respectful, yeah. They are self-centered and self-agendaed, the Woolies give to. We saw them, you know, helping each other, giving each other food, doing art for the sheer joy of it.
Mm-hmm.
And just living a wonderful, peaceful life that even the head Woolly was like.
Yeah, most creatures never get to experience the life that we built.
And they knew how good they had it. And the thing is, they had not really been challenged much by anything outside, so they had the privilege of building that kind of society. For anybody that listens to our other podcast, which is called Jumpgate, the Babylon 5 Rewatch podcast, we've been doing that for a couple of years. For anybody who's just listened to this podcast, we made a point that the Minbari, who are the enlightened space elves in that space opera, have the same idea. There's at one point in the series they go to war. One caste goes to war against the other. The warrior caste is trying to take everything over. The religious caste is trying to stop them. And what they run into is they're not fighting over food or land or power or anything. They want to control the ideals. They're way up. There are no poor Minbari. There are no homeless Minbari. They're all well taken care of. All of their physical educational needs are all met. The war they were having was a war of ideals, which included burning their cities and terrorizing them. But they didn't actually march through the city shooting people. So in this case, the Critchellites weren't marching through shooting it. They didn't have any weapons of death on them.
That's
they had
true.
Weapons of oppression.
Mm-hmm.
They had electrical shackles, and they did it through the orb, which is a terribly mysterious piece of technology they brought with them. The orb seems to be able to, it's a multifunctional device, which apparently can both shackle them with energy things that also seems to drain their will, and also keeps them from using their mental abilities, because the enlightened guru guy was not shackled. He was just put in place. He couldn't move. He couldn't do anything. They knew he couldn't do anything. I suspect that a lot of, if he has the power to dream walk like that, that he had the power to do that with other willies and share experiences. That might be why he was so enlightened, because he could see through the perspective of so many of his people.
And why the one rebellious wooly also was as enlightened as he was, considering his whole life probably was spent as a slave.
Yeah, it's probably innate in the woolies at this point that's how they're supposed to work. They're supposed to be connected. The whole race is a metaphor in this cartoon. So Jack's like, I gotta get you guys out of here. I can't.
So the orb, or the like tower, the structure that holds the orb and the orb on top, really seems like an aesthetic callback to the teleporters that we saw in the first episode.
Oh yeah. Susie Triclops went through.
A lot of the Aku based technology has a similar aesthetic theme with the horns and that black and red, you know.
Everything has to look like Aku.
And it can't possibly be the Critcholites who built these things, because it doesn't resemble any of their technology. It doesn't look like it.
I'm even willing to believe that the orb technology and the tridents they were using were purchased. Like, maybe their race purchased these from Aku.
They certainly seem interested in mercantile.
And sent all of their most annoying clones.
Send to Earth our most annoying clones
to find this. And for Aku, as soon as he realized who and what the Woolies were, oh, what a very rich vein of misery to be mined from these wonderful, peaceful, happy, calm people.
And especially they were isolated.
Oh yes. Nothing else can bother them. Jungle and hills and mountains everywhere. Not easy to come to their aid. They didn't talk to many other people. This kind of goes back to Shangri-La as well. The legend of Shangri-La in Nepal was always spring. It was always beautiful. There's plants, and it's in the middle of like huge, enormous mountains, and there's only one tiny pass to get there, and no one ever dies, and it's constantly beautiful. And the idea is these were their own little Shangri-La, you know, their own little Eden.
Right.
Was here, surrounded and protected by these mountains that also kept them from leaving, or anyone from bothering their oppressors who arrived via Aku Space Needle. And it really, those things didn't seem to be designed to do much more than just get them there. They didn't bring any equipment with them at all. They just plunk right down and came out and enslaved the populace. This goes back to the shock doctrine thing.
Yeah. So, but what we see is Jack sees this and he immediately agrees to help.
Mm-hmm.
Even though his actual main mission will erase this action anyway. Yep. It is utterly meaningless for him to do this.
Yep. And he risks his life for nothing. The thing is, I think even his father would have helped them out. Even his father would have felt the pull of this and would have said, I can easily get them out of the situation. You know, with some work, this can be done. Okay, it won't be easy, but it is simple.
Yeah, I mean, and
then break the orb, unenslave them, and then they can take care of themselves.
It says basically these souls will not suffer so long as they continue to exist. So I can see that it's noble. It's just a bit of a distraction.
His father would have been a bit more directed, but he's also a good man. And I think he probably would have found a way to help them. Even if he didn't take Jack's approach, he still would have tried to find a way. And I think Lazal, whatever his name was, Jerry Garcia, I think he would have even noted that about Jack's father, would have said, okay, you are a man of honor. You are a man of spirituality, a man of order and structure. And this is wrong. And it would have offended Jack's father's sense of order and structure and peaceable kingdom. He would have just gone crazy about this. So he's like, okay, we've got to get there and shut this thing down. This is horrible. Where do we need to go? Well, the orb is over here. They used it to enslave us. They used it to oppress us. And they've had us doing all their dirty work ever since. We've been hauling shit around and, you know, meaningless stuff. Again, we saw them like hauling rocks, walking in circles in a circus. Yep. It's the same meaningless tripe that Aku did with the people when Jack returned.
Yep.
Inspire misery, break them. Make them so that them and any generation after them has no hope. and then give them a little bit of hope, and then you can farm that misery with a little bit of hope in the future. You know, let a slave uprising happen once in a while. Then you kill off the most violent of them and crush their hopes for a little bit. So when it comes to this, they're like, okay, there's the tower. It's surrounded by a carpet of sleeping bastards, and we need to get there and get up that tower. So again, they have to kind of sneak.
Yep.
Which is,
again, you mentioned, hey, it's a little weird to see this giant thing sneaking. And in the end, it doesn't really work out that well.
Yeah, he'd roll the one.
Eventually, he falls down into the pit of sleeping assholes. And,
God. So, Jack is doing this awesome job of like leaping around using some of that wushu skill.
Yeah, extra quietly.
And doesn't wake a single one up. In fact, halfway up the tower as he's climbing, he crumbles, part of it crumbles, and he catches him with his toes. Like, and you hear this. And it implies that he moved his foot around to catch all the gravel.
Shaolin movie moment there. Mm-hmm.
And then the next scene, he's wearing his little tabby shoes again, his little clogs. But he makes it almost all the way up to the top. And then the Wooly that's watching him leaning more and more forward, like, is he going to make it? Falls over the wall. And they don't say that he kills him, but he probably kills them.
Yeah.
And goes splat. And the brick that he knocked off goes splat on another one. The thing is, it kills them immediately. It kills them right away. They don't make a sound. The only reason that they really wake up is because
one of the dead one's feet lands on the head of one that's still lying
next to him. Yeah. Again, they wouldn't have helped each other. No one woke up for their common defense. They were all too busy sleeping. You took out these individuals. The ones around them didn't move a muscle. Only when one of their sleeps was disturbed.
Yeah.
Hey, you bothered my sleep. And they look over. Oh, crap.
Yeah, so we see that they realize that he's escaped again, and Samurai Jack jumps to action. He actually rolls a bluff check.
Mm-hmm.
He pretends like he's going to recapture the Wooly, and the Wooly believes it too. He makes this distraught face, like, you know.
Well, he's lived a life of oppression.
Yep.
Like, he would have come to expect that from anybody that was even remotely friendly. Like, well, I've been treated this way my whole life by the space nerds. I guess this guy wasn't what I thought. But, you know, Jack's whole idea was to put this tone in his voice that he has now sussed these guys out. You know, he makes them believe him. And it works.
Yep.
Yeah, let's attack them, which gives him a chance to get set up.
Yeah, so he once again
throws his fucking sword. Stop throwing your fucking sword, Jack.
It's the trump card. It always works. It always works. It always seals Aku. It always breaks the chains. And he actually destroys the shock collar.
Which he intuits is under there. I don't think he ever really saw, he saw them encircling.
Right.
But it was kind of a guess that that's what was there. I'm thinking, even if he had thought about doing something before, until he had that enlightened moment with the guru, he wouldn't have known exactly where to throw it. And that was a precise throw.
Yeah.
A handspan to either side, he would have killed the Wooly. But he naturally hit the electrical thing and went bzzz. And of course, it doesn't do shit to a magic sword, which falls dramatically point first into the earth. And the Wooly looks down, silently going, wait, am I free? Is this real? And then the space nerds look up and go, I can't believe this. Is the Wooly actually free? You know, it's in their faces.
Yeah.
And then the Wooly stands up.
Yep. And it's this huge moment of sort of defiance of everything that's happened to him so far.
And his expression changes. It was clearly the shock collar and the orb that was repressing any sense of rebellion. The fact that that thing managed to run at all meant that it had somehow escaped those bonds, because all the rest of them were in them all the time.
Right.
Somehow that one, right before the episode started, was able to get out of them, or maybe it didn't take, or maybe two of the Critcholites got in an argument and forgot to bind that one. He took his shot, took his chance, and ran off. And they tracked him down. They spent no small amount of time torturing him before putting it back on. Make sure he's nice and cowed. And as soon as they were off, he remembered what it was to be woolly. And that good does not mean soft. And he starts laying about him with the fury of a cave troll.
Yeah.
In one of those movies with elves that we like so much.
Yeah.
Throwing them everywhere, smashing them. And it's like, oh, this has been a long time coming.
And we see
repressed rage.
Jack begins to fight hand to hand with the enemy.
Yeah, he jumps that. He knows he can't get up because if he tries to go back across those vines or whatever, they're just going to stab him up. They have the reach with those weapons. So he's like, I have to work my way over to where my sword is.
Yep. And we see that one of the things I wanted to note, it's very interesting to me because yeah, I do some animation stuff, and it's really cool to see that the animators had the martial arts aspects of this situation in mind. They didn't have him do Northern style wushu. He wasn't jumping around. You know, this wasn't a from above mindset. What he was using was most likely more reminiscent of the Southern style wushu.
That's actually looked more like Taekwondo to me. The short, sharp punches, back fists, that looked like Taekwondo.
When we saw him pick up the chalk staff thing that they use is what I'm talking about.
Oh, right. Okay.
Where we see him start to just sweep feet and, you know, full on, you know, both feet firmly grounded. I'm already above you.
Yeah.
I don't need to jump.
He's already a giant by Critcholite standards.
Yeah. It was cool. I really enjoy that. The animators take the situation into mind where you'll see a lot of other cartoons, even action. They will use stuff that doesn't make too much sense in the situation simply because it looks cool or it's, you know, that's a signature attack. Well,
it doesn't make sense here.
Exactly.
Like, what would he do a signature attack for? He's underwater. Or he's on a tower or the wind is blowing really hard. Like that move wouldn't exactly work the way you expect it to in this situation. But again, that goes back to our speculation at the beginning. Jack's adaptable. Jack has a toolbox full of different fighting styles that he can call upon for the situation. In this case, this is a bar brawl. And I'm going to have to move my way to the sword this way. And I'm going to pick up one of their staffs. And now I have reach and I'm a giant to them. So that gives him the edge he needs to get back to his real weapon, his sword, which he then uses to every time they try. At one point when he picks it up and he goes into his power stance, and there's a bit that I took a screenshot of. Maybe I can share that on the blog where he's literally blocked in. They're all standing there with their tridents, and it like frames him in the tridents with like angry faces on either side.
Right, yeah.
The show is so full of like awesome comic book panels. It's great. And at that point, when they look at this, they're like, okay, we need to get to the tower. Like we have to destroy the orb. If we don't do this, it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So he finally gets there.
Well, what really happens is they work together.
Yeah,
Jack and the Wooly work together.
Once he reaches him and they can combine their forces,
They get to the tower, Jack jumps on top of the Wooly's back, and they start climbing.
The Wooly sprouts fingers. Where do those come from?
They walked on all fours. Very Wooly hands.
Mm-hmm.
So he's climbing up, and the Wooly, who's lived his whole life just doing regular labor, feels like he can't do it. Climbing this tower, doing all this, it's too much for him. And he tells Jack, I can't do it. And Jack
I'm too weak. I can't do it. Yeah.
Promptly stabs him in the ass.
With the sword.
And as is typical of your cartoon shows, getting stabbed in the ass adds rocket propulsion to anybody. You inflict this type of wound.
I would believe in this case, though, it actually tracks more true than it would in other cartoons for a laugh. Woolies are incredibly strong. They're incredibly well-built creatures. And the shock of being actually hit with pain that isn't from a shock collar. I mean, there was as much surprise as pain. Jack didn't try to hurt him. He just jabbed him. I mean, this is the whole thing there is a metaphor for good leadership. Like everything that happened that Jack did was enabling the Woolies. He did what he could in order to let them save themselves because it has much more meaning and they are far more willing to fight when it's for them.
Yeah.
So he did everything he could to enable them to win.
Yeah, and we see that.
And sometimes a leader needs to poke you in the ass to get you to move.
The one that actually breaks the orb is the Wooly.
Yeah, because he sails up into the air and hangs there for a dramatic moment and then falls back. Despite himself, lands on the orb. Crack!
The orb! He broke the orb! I can't believe... Huh?
Yeah, look, they all say it the same way. There's guys up on a cliff who are like, look, don't let them get to the orb! They're getting to the orb! Oh, no! And it's like all of them say it the same way. It's just like this moment of hilarity in the middle of a battle scene. Signature of Samurai Jack, by the way. And the shackles come off, and all of the other Woolies have woken up. And they realize... we're free. And they come over to where the battlefield is, where all of these Critcholites are trying to climb the tower behind them. And a really cool, probably one of the few computerized effects they had. It was a little too smooth. Watching them come out of the background, evenly spaced up the tower, like that was probably like 25, 30 frames of computer animation. They slip it in every now and then, where things are just a bit too smooth. But it looked cool. It left this impression that these things are all the same. There's not a single individual among them. They're all the same.
They're a monoculture.
Yeah. To an nth degree, like an annoying monoculture.
Yeah.
And when all this is happening, you know, this is the only time we really see them working together is to try to climb the tower to get them down. Like that's, oh God, that's the one thing that can bring them together is the threat of losing their slaves. And the other Woolies arrive and now shit gets real.
Your weapons are worthless now. This is our home.
Ah! Yeah, as soon as they realize that their whole project is basically gone to shit, there's no reason for them to stay on Earth. Mm-hmm. They don't have slaves. And they don't have any place to colonize anymore.
And they don't have any developed infrastructure.
Right. So they just book it. They leave. This place is of no consequence. Losing it means nothing to them. They just leave.
Having it meant nothing. And maybe that's like the biggest fuck you that they give to the Woolies. This meant nothing to us.
Yep.
Like to any other sociopath, they don't care if you're under emotional duress from being gaslighted. They don't care that their actions are making you feel unsure of yourself and crazy. They don't care that any of the things going on that they do, that they blame on you or try to reframe to make you look or feel crazy or lie about doesn't mean anything to them. It's a game. It's nothing. They're not hurt by it.
I don't even care. I've got better property on a different planet.
Yeah, this place blows, you guys. Let's go. So in the end, it wasn't even – that was the most insidious thing about the Critcholites as villains. There was no ideal to fight. There was no oppression driven by anything other than the massive number of clones who had annoying asshole personalities.
Yeah, honestly, the only thing they were contending – philosophically speaking, was that their treatment of the Woolies was the same as how humans treat horses, mm-hmm. which was wrong.
How humans treat circus animals. Because zoos didn't even treat things that bad. As soon as they realized putting an animal in a cage for a long time was bad, they started creating habitats for them.
Right.
You know, you see the old cartoons of like, you know, a lion on a cement pillar in a cage. In a literal
cage, yes.
It's like, no, the lion's going to go insane and die. You don't put animals like that.
Eventually it loses its sense of reality and time. It just stops eating and drinking, you know?
Mm-hmm. And the effect that the alien annoying sociopaths had on the poor Woolies was, you know, the Woolies even then were like, we want justice, but not revenge. They didn't attack the ships. They didn't say
that's true. They didn't say charge
the ships and try to take them over. There was no human style level of counterattack. They just wanted them driven off. They just wanted to end the fight, like most enlightened people want to do. Your job is not to kill the bully. Your job is to defeat the bully, so the bully knows that they've been beaten and they'll move on to something easier if they're sociopaths like that. So they get in their old ass ships and take off. I gotta wonder if Haku makes note of this.
Who knows? I mean, this episode, while it is a cool and interesting one to watch, really has very little effect on the story.
Yeah, well, they're isolated. I mean, as far as we know, these are the only Woolies there are. They're not everywhere in the galaxy. We didn't see any in Hub City or the central hub. We're in that bar. And
actually,
they would make hell of a mercenary. They're huge and strong and somewhat telepathic. If they decided to go evil, they'd have some advantages.
It might be interesting to keep an eye out and see if Critcholites appear in any other...
In the background scenes?
Yeah, because it seems like they would be the type of guys, you know, just to be randomly in town.
They're too self-centered to work for anybody. Like, that's that particular true. Clone strain, they're not interested in having a job. They're not interested in controlling large amounts of people. They're not interested in making lots of money, although they are interested in getting what's theirs.
A job? How do you have time to afford hobbies?
Exactly. How am I supposed to collect the latest action figure if I have to work? Yeah, they're just horrible, horrible. They expect everything to be given to them. You know, they're horrible people. And you can almost see how this little ecosystem of repression works in Aku's favor. They have an Aku style of evil. Aku responds. His evil, it's not an expansive evil that's ambitious. Aku just takes advantage of opportunities.
Yep.
If he sees one that comes his way, he'll do it. Otherwise, he'll just stay there. That's pretty much for the last however many thousand years. Oh, an alien race came here?
Yeah, it's worth noting.
I can exploit them, sure. But he doesn't think about that
all
the time.
They're both exploitive, cruel evils, but they're also both quite sentient, you know? They're quite self-aware. They're sapient. And
self-centered.
Yep.
It's all about me. It's only always ever about me. And Aku surely shows that a lot. And the few times that he tries to make it not about him, it comes off truly hilariously.
Yeah.
Whenever Aku tries to do something that isn't about him. I'm looking at the fairy tales episode. Oh,
when we get there.
When we get there. But yeah, these seem to be another misery farm. And yep. Jack comes along and it's this little scrap of technology. Oh, it's a mind control device. Yeah, they sell these. They sell these out in the galaxy to keep slave populations in line. Yeah, no problem.
Yeah.
And Aku probably said, okay, I'll sell you some. I have a contractor. And they went, great. Here's the money. True. Thanks. And he's like, well, going out there and yes, you will go there and suppress the Woolies. And maybe that enlightened Woolly was kind of a thorn in Aku's side for a while. I'm thinking the darkness.
It seems like it, yeah.
If that's true, that means the darkness they talk about were decades ago, quote unquote, when the Critcholites arrived. It seems to be that he's probably close enough to that wasteland that he might have realized that that's where the Dog City was too. So if he sent them out there and Aku suddenly paid attention to that part of the world and went, oh, there's a broken city with all this overgrown crystal over the last 1,000 years.
Right.
Oh, right. The dogs. Right. I beat the dogs back and now there's new crystal. Sure, sure. I can go get that. Oh, and I can pluck 2 carrots with one hand and send the Critcholites out here to farm some more misery.
Right. Exactly.
And like this all fits perfectly with Aku's mode of operation. And, you know, he, like we said, he can be terribly cunning, but not necessarily ambitious or even smart. At the very end of it, we see that the enlightened guru is humbled and is very grateful to Jack.
Yeah, we see, one, now that the chains have been broken, that, enlightened Wooly kid hover and he flies over.
Supernatural.
Lands.
Again. Yeah.
And it shakes the ground.
Yeah.
He tells Jack about a place to the north as his hair merges with the sky above and he just.
We are forever grateful, great warrior, to your deeds done today. If there is anything that you seek, please honor us by letting us help you.
There is one thing that I quest for.
Yes, I understand. Travel north, samurai. There you will find a magical place that can help you fulfill your destiny.
He's a little miniature god. Like, I would even put him many levels above the monks on the mountaintop. Because he's not just a conduit for the gods, he's going out, he's sending his own consciousness out to explore and look at things. And because as soon as Jack says, I do actually have a quest, and Jack says, I need to find Aku, you know, basically, and he just thinks it really hard. And
yep,
the enlightened one looks at him and he says, I know who you seek. And Aku is in his eyes. Like, almost like, yeah, Aku and I have gone a round or two.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, but what we see is this impressionistic image of Jack walking to the north, the enlightened Wooly, his
in the sky.
Visage in the sky, say, remember who you are. You are my son and the one true king.
This is CNN.
Yeah, they basically told the voice actor, do the deepest possible voice you can. I don't think they augmented it much, if any. The voice actor who did that really nailed it. Here's another thought that just occurred to me right now because we were talking about clones. What if the Woolies were essentially clones? What if the Woolies don't have sexual reproduction? What if they bud? Hmm. That means that that Wooly might have spawned all of the rest of them.
Yeah, you know, there doesn't appear to be differently gendered Woolies.
They all have the same face. They all have the same...
Then again, there exist hyenas, just so we're clear. There are animals out there whose gender is utterly undeterminable except with DNA testing, whose genitals are identical between male and female for whatever reason. And you're not going to figure it out until you see some blood, you know?
It's a survival strategy. I mean, when you think about how and where hyenas live, like a survival strategy would be you don't know which ones of us are childbearing. Therefore, you can't target them in order to take out our tribe. Yeah, you can't smell any different. Males and females don't necessarily smell any different. So any predator coming around wouldn't know to take out the mother or the mothers first.
Easy targets, hunting down the babies, you know.
If they were some form of clone or budding off of the main guy, then that would all, like, you know, Gorons in the Zelda, you know, for example, they don't have sexual reproduction. They bud and they call each other brother in the Zelda universe.
Yep.
And Gorons are big rock guys, sort of like happy trolls and just spawn another Goron that pops off of them like a gremlin and they're a little kid. They act like little children and they have progenitors who act like parents to them.
Yep.
So it's like a race of single parents. In this case, I would say that it seems to me as if the guru, if that happened, had spawned all of them and each of them was an extension of his consciousness to a degree. So if all of them were held shackled and chained, he was held, his body was physically held shackled. He could, his, the bits of his consciousness were being repressed and he couldn't leave or ask for help. He had to wait for something to come along for that to happen. Maybe he was starting to make inroads. Maybe he did find different ways to screw with the Critcholites, because if he did have mental powers, why wasn't he dominating all the Critcholites?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, maybe that's part of what made them so afraid to get close. Remember, they said the mind control powers will fry your brain.
Maybe that's how they defended themselves at first.
Yeah, maybe.
Anybody that tried to take him, he fried their brains.
Like, yeah, maybe it's true that that particular one did fry someone's brain. Who knows? It's hard to say because all we got was, you know, a couple of lines and then
we don't know what the
thing protecting. You're seeking is north of here. And,
that's probably a good enough thing to get Jack on his way though. I mean, Jack walks the earth anyway. So going north. Okay.
That narrows it down.
Sure. I'll ask around.
Oh, where are we?
There was a portal. There's a
close to the equator. All right. So you mean half of the entire planet. Thanks.
Somewhere in that direction for thousands of miles. So, yeah, it would be a nice symmetry, too, if I hadn't mentioned that. It would be a nice a coup-style symmetry where you send an army of annoying clones, annoying self-centered sociopathic clones, to undertake to repress a bunch of budded-off enlightened Woolies who are all part of the same literally all budded-off the same thing. So both of them are replicative, but for one, those replications were viewpoints, like, you know, the Geth in Mass Effect, you know, the Geth experience is defined by perspective. So every time he would bud one of these things out, we can assume that each of them would have different experiences and all of those experiences are funneled back through him. And he gets to the enlightenment he experiences is living all of their lives. And it was very peaceful. They didn't need much. They focused on art and play and having enough food to live. And you could see that it would be a cunning and very evil thing for Aku to do. To, you know, how he did with the Wadaquians, where he's like, well, you'll go out to the ocean and you'll build me statues above the ocean surface.
Yeah.
Because it will annoy you and it will cause you distress to have to build above the ocean when you're not comfortable.
Once a month.
Yeah. And then when you see them sending out a whole bunch of annoying clones who are horrible and all the same and completely unenlightened to oppress the butted off experience chain that is the Woolly experience. That, for me, makes a lot of headcanon sense. And one of the reasons I love Samurai Jack is because you can construct these things, and based on what you've seen, they make perfect sense.
Yeah. You know,
headcanon
the themes of the episode are clear. The metaphors are plainly stated. And from there, it just comes down to, you know, well, we know what they were going for thematically, but how does this make sense, you know? And what do we see? We see that we've got this society of enlightened individuals, self-sufficient. They could live in peace infinitely, and they'll be oppressed by a group of self-centered, you know, lazy guys who couldn't take care of themselves for 3 seconds without the suit that takes care of all their needs and the beasts of burden that they use for menial tasks and entertainment when they have enough technology to make those suits. They have enough technology to make a TV station.
I'm sure that those were heads up display. The goggle things they were wearing over their eyes, those were all heads up displays. They could watch whatever. They didn't show them doing it, but I'm sure they could.
Yeah, like sure why else would they have goggles, you know, safety first? No, I don't think so.
Well, cell phone reception is shitty in the middle of the mountains, Matt. I mean, you don't even have one bar out there. So maybe it was before, but when they got there, they realized we have no cell phone signal. But maybe that's why they stayed there. Maybe they had never been contacted for all those decades from anybody from their home world. No one had checked in. Yeah. They thought they died. Maybe they thought the Woolies had taken them over. But you know what? That suits Aku's needs. His planet isn't being overrun by Critcholites. Right. And instead, he gets this wonderful misery farm. And for a scrap of technology that he captured or bought from somewhere else in the galaxy, all of this is it's double and triple to Aku's advantage. These clones will live indefinitely in these things. They're not being checked with, and they have not enough ambition to send one of them back out into cell phone range to call home and say, you know, hey, we repress these things. What next? Can we go home now? I'm really behind on Game of Thrones. You know, they don't do any of that. So that's how unambitious they are. They'd perfectly fine living right there. They don't even want to move once they were stuck. I don't think Aku knew this, but it is playing out to his advantage. So I love the direction this is sending him again. The dog set a precedent for Jack. Jack had to struggle with that for a minute. But I think also his environment, he was in a natural environment again. He was out in the woods in the woody jungle. And it made him feel a lot more at peace being among the green than it did being in Hub City.
Yeah,
the central hub.
That was just overwhelming and different. And riding in spaceships and stuff.
Rocket cars.
It was all too much.
With talking dogs.
Yeah.
That was just bizarre.
The dogs I knew walked on all fours.
And barked.
Yeah.
And in this case, well, it's green jungle and there's a boar. I know what a boar is. They're edible. You know, I'm walking around someplace beautiful looking for an answer and trying to come across people who might be able to help me. It's a much more natural thing for how he was trained. Running up against something as violently annoying as the Critcholites. This is probably the reason that the guru wanted to help him too. He saw in Jack this disciplined mind.
Yep.
Much like his own. You know, a human who is much younger, but kind of like the way we regard one of those child actors. The girl in Logan, for example. You can't believe that a girl that young is that powerful of an actor. Same deal. He probably looked at Jack and went, I can't believe a human this young is this enlightened.
Right.
Already at this age. Usually it takes humans most of a lifetime to get there. Well, Jack had expert training for most of his life. That's all he did. So, of course, he put in his 100,000 hours to become a grandmaster. So far, so good with this series. It was one of the first real episodes that was standalone. Like, you kind of could have watched this out of order.
Yeah, this one definitely feels like a sort of a misadventure, but it has to. One thing to note is, because of the way it ends, you should watch it before the one we're going to see, just because he says you should go north at the end of it.
Okay. So that kind of brings us near the end of the episode. What do we got up for next time?
Well, next time we'll be talking about the episode where Jack meets some different space travelers. And we get to see a different side of the Nerdoverse and Genndy Tartakovsky's interpretation of them.
Yeah, so, the stranded spaceman.
Yeah, but that should be interesting.
And that's another kind of interesting twist on an old trope. We've crashed here on an alien planet, and clearly those aliens in the next episode were part of some bigger space opera that I would have loved to have seen a show about. But the art direction in that one is as different from this one as this one was from Hub City. Like, the colors, the palettes, everything is different. So, I believe that brings us to the end of our episode. Thank you again for joining us for Backjack, the Samurai Jack Rewatch podcast. I'm Andy.
And I'm Matt.
And we will see you guys next time.
Thanks for listening.
See ya. Got some thoughts about the show you gotta get off your chest? Are we completely wrong, or do you love the podcast with a burning passion? Why not let us know? Contacting Andy and Matt is easy. Find us on Facebook. Email us at backjackpodcast@gmail.com. See our notes and reference links over at backjackblog.wordpress.com. Shoot us a tweet at backjackpodcast. And listen directly at, you guessed it, backjack.podomatic.com. That awesome Samurai Jack music remix that you've heard was done by Musicality Music, and you can check out the rest of his stuff at www.musicalitymusic.net. Backjack the Samurai Jack Rewatch Podcast is a Ninja White Star production.